Yeah, internet exhibitionism about business. But thank you for joining us. Thank you all for joining us. This is really exciting. That wasn't a complaint. It's just a little unusual. But this is like really the first time we've ever done this. And so we're really glad you're here. So thank you for coming.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So so we've got our 30 by 500 bootcamp coming up next weekend. But today's not about the bootcamp. It's not about really even 30 by 500. This is a slightly different conversation. Right, Amy?
Absolutely. We're today, like I said earlier, talking about specifically how do you go from freelancing or consulting to building a product business. And again, if you're employed and you have a regular job and you're on this webinar, I hate that word. If you're on this call and you have a regular job, a lot of this will apply to you, but you'll have to kind of like mentally translate it a little bit to your situation. But we're specifically focusing on folks who are freelancing or consulting, or who are going to be freelancing or consulting and who want to also build a product business.
We do have some tips for the folks who are in a job. Maybe, you know, the reality is if you're here in, and I guess this is time zone dependent, but if you're anywhere in the US and you have a job and you're here with us today, that probably means you're more in control of your time than a lot of the people out there. So good on you.
Realize how much you are in control of your time.
Exactly, exactly. So I think we're going to have some good stuff for you as well.
Awesome. So we thought we'd start off with a story. Yay. So gather around, everyone. Let's make s'mores. this is what I say when there's no one to give me funny looks. I want to tell you a little bit about how we built Freckle. Now, in case you aren't familiar with like my main business, it's an app called Freckle. It's a software as a service, so subscription web app, specifically time tracking, invoicing, expense tracking for freelancers and consultants. And we aim it now specifically at small teams agencies. Now, in 2008, we didn't have any products. Thomas and I were consulting. I was actually consulting with another friend of mine, and then I quit that sort of little company that we created and started consulting with Thomas, and we got different types of projects, but we didn't have any products at all. And I had accidentally been offline for an entire month in New Zealand because there was no internet in New Zealand back then. And I just realized how much I hated consulting. Now, I'd known my entire, you know, like for years and years, I ought to create products, that that's the way to have economic freedom, to not be constantly looking for new business, hoping someone would hire me again or anew to do something for them, like waiting to be picked and used for someone else's business purpose. So I knew that I really had to do it because I finally realized just how much I hated consulting. And so we sat down and we looked for problems, for pains that we had and that other people we knew had that we could find information about online, and ended up designing Freckle Time Tracking when I was really hungover, but that's another story. So this was June of 2008, and December of 2008, we actually launched the very first version of Freckle. So that's how many months? I can't do math. That's like 6 months, right? Right?
Yes, June, that's
December.
Correct. Yeah.
6 months. Yeah.
That's 6 months.
I can count, sort of. No one ever complains that the year is 12 months long, but they are always like, let's use the metric system because everything's tens and hundreds. What's with that? Welcome to my brain. I'm sorry.
But you digress.
I digress. I'm sorry. I digress. So 6 months from coming up, well, actually a little more than coming up with what pain we were going to solve, and then actually doing wireframey interaction design, really basic, just like these are the things that really suck, and so our product is going to do the opposite, in June, to launching a really crappy first version in December. We worked on and off for 5 months in between kind of an international move and wedding. We would work usually every Friday all day, like a long day, and sometimes on the weekends as well. At that time, we were working with another tiny development company, but as well, it didn't work out, shall we say. We were partnering, and they just stopped working, so our partnership broke up. But I calculated that we spent about 180 hours to build the first version of Freckle. That's all together. That's all of us. So if you think about it, that sounds like a lot. But then I realized that if you sit down and you watch all of Buffy seasons 1 through 7 for two people, it is the same amount of time. And unlike watching Buffy, which has never really paid me back, and other than, enjoyment in the moment, Freckle has just passed $1 million in life, or no, sorry, well, almost has almost passed $1 million in lifetime revenue. It'll do that around December, around its 5th birthday. So we took time that we could have spent consulting, and it would have paid us pretty well at the time, and then we took time that we could have spent hanging out and watching TV. Like this, the amount of hours is just not ridiculous to get a first version out there. And yes, we had to keep working on it, and yes, there were struggles there, but that has turned into a lot of money, a viable business. We could live on Freckle alone and with our employees and be perfectly comfortable, not rich, but very comfortable. And that's even without it,
And
any
that
kind of
hundred,
heroic effort.
and Amy, that 180 hours, give or take, was over that full length of time. Was that was like a year and change?
No, that was, let's see. I'm gonna calculate here how many hours that is. So
The point
it was
being is
over.
that 180 hours was spread out over time. You weren't working on it full
Yeah.
time. This was
Yeah,
on the
it's like
side.
40 hours a month.
Right.
40 hours a month.
So a week out of a month or a day out of a week, give or
A
take.
day out of a week. And some weekends also.
Sure.
So it wasn't like we didn't wait till we had tons of money to quit working and focus on Freckle only. We di also didn't do any kind of heroic efforts, I think, whatsoever. Now, this was just all for the version one. Like, we've shipped it without all kinds of things that people now consider required. But we shipped it. The one pain that it solved was time entry being a pain in the ass. So we had really good time entry, and everything else kind of sucked. But that still got us right away to $1,500 a month in paying customers. Now, as at that time when we launched Freckle and it started making $1,500 a month because we launched it properly, $1,500 a month is not enough to live on for one person, much less two. When you've been consulting for, big clients or even medium-sized clients or small clients, that's not a lot of money at all. That wouldn't have paid our rent. But so we kept working on it on the side. On the side, we took smaller contracts and charged more. And for a while, we were very reliably carving out time to build Freckle, to support, to fix bugs, to add new features. And then things got really stressful in the consulting business, and we just couldn't focus on two things at once at all. And we neglected Freckle for like 3 or 4 months. It got to the point the last couple months we didn't even answer email support. So yeah, we. As you might expect, we lost some customers, but surprisingly, we did not lose all of our customers or even a significant portion. We lost a few customers. We went back to the old emails, wrote back and apologized to most of them. If they'd already canceled, it was just like, well, water under the bridge. We just ignored the email at that point. We crawled back out from under that, and even though it felt really terrible, but once we were past that, we kept working on Freckle again. And there was another time when we slacked off when I was super sick, but it still maintained or slightly grew during this period. However, I didn't fully quit consulting for a year after we launched. So we launched in December 2008, and I quit consulting in January 2010. Thomas consulted for a bit more because he had really lucrative and low-stress clients that I did not. And once I started really focusing on Freckle more like half-time instead of just really on the side, it grew and grew and grew. It went from like 30 grand to over $100,000 a year in revenue, just in that like 6 to 8 month time period. So it didn't grow hugely when we were kind of like, it was like the baby side project, but as soon as we put more time into it, it grew a lot.
So, Amy, what I think what's interesting about the way you sort of can look at this experience in hindsight is I think you had a mix of sort of the typical things that people run into. It's, the distractions of the other consulting work, sometimes health issues, and just life comes up, and the stress of juggling multiple things. And so, having that hindsight be 2020 as it tends to be, you're able to sort of look back and say, here's all the things that I can now do intentionally in terms of carving out that time, right?
Yes. There's really, we made so many mistakes. We really just made so many mistakes. And there's things I would do differently. But at the same time, I'm glad that we made those mistakes because they moved us forward. So I wouldn't recommend doing it just like we did. But at the same time, I've learned so much that I can make recommendations if that makes sense.
So when it really comes down to it, there was all of these factors, whether it was, again, the other consulting clients or just stresses of life that were seemed like outside influences, like outside effects. And everybody's got these sort of like pockets of danger around them that, when I'm trying to make this transition, it feels like something always pops up that's going to pull me away from the thing that I know is what I need to be working. Like all this entire time, you knew that you wanted to be working on Freckle and building a product that
Yeah.
could pay dividends over time. So, we've got with all of these things sort of chasing after you, how do you decide which? How do you know what to focus on, what to pay attention to? What had to change in your mindset in order to even in spite of all of the mistakes, make this work?
Well, that is a good question. I think that most of us, if not all of us, kind of grow up learning to focus on whatever screams the loudest, and that we wait for people to present us what to do. Your parents tell you what to do, and then school tells you what to do, and then your job tells you what to do. Even if you're fairly entrepreneurial in your job, you know that there's someone somewhere who's going to sign off on your work, or if you don't do anything, eventually complain. That is not really so true with products. And if you're consulting, it's the same situation. I don't know, if you don't call your client for a month and you don't have anything to show for it, they will probably end up firing you or at least writing you a very nasty email. But that's not really true with customers, especially when your business is early. There's very little pressure there. And so you cannot rely on this the way that you've always worked, which is to rely on pressure or external forces or some sort of authority figure to tell you what to focus on. You tend to work on what's in front of you and what pops up and what's loud or painful or scary, and the products at first, they're just not that way. So you really have to break out of that mindset. And that's a terribly difficult habit to overcome. But the question is really, how do you know what to focus on? Well, you focus on what's most important to you. You have to really want to run a separate business, to run a product business, to have customers, to not be selling your time for an hourly rate. You have to really want that. And I think a lot of people, when they set out to create a product business, they think they should do it, but they don't really, really deep down want it. And I did. And I still screwed up. So we like to, in our class, guys, we like to tell people that there's this joke that everyone knows. Two guys go camping. And real camping, not like I'm basically in an RV park and there are toilets and showers camping.
No, like
And
out in the wilderness camping,
the
like
actual wilderness.
Yellowstone.
Yeah, they're actually in the actual wilderness where there's actual wilds. I'm going to use the word actually once more. And they know what they ought to do, but they don't do all the things they ought to do. They're sitting in their campfire and they're eating, and then they leave their food out, and then they're in their tents at night and they hear a sound, and they know what the sound is. It's a bear. They're fucked. Pardon my English. So they leap out of their tents, and the first guy starts running, and the second guy is like, "What the hell? You can't run from a bear. You can't outrun a bear." And the first guy who's running says, "I don't need to outrun the bear. I only need to outrun you." And this is a cheesy old joke, but I think it really illustrates well the issue with trying to build a product business when you're doing something else. Because the bear will eat you. And the dude you have to outrun, metaphorically, is your old way of doing things.
So all of your old habits, the need to react in order to get things done, the in order to be able to choose what to focus on and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. Your inclination to focus on whatever is going to hurt you the most if you don't get it done. Like, that will no longer work. The bear will eat you. But at the same time, I don't actually recommend that people like save up money and quit their job or quit consulting and have a runway to like focus entirely on the product, because it's really a kind of fantasy. The fantasy, same fantasy that says, if only I had a cabin in the wilderness, I would write the great American novel. or if only I had this great exercise equipment at home, I would get totally ripped. And if you've ever fallen prey to that fantasy and actually bought the things or done the things, you realize it is a fantasy. The fantasy of total focus on your product is not going to help you, because if you can't prioritize the product when it's on the side of your consulting business, when you're actually running the product full time, you're not going to be able to focus on growth versus responding to support requests, or marketing versus feature development, or administrative work versus, you know, growing the product, or, you know, it's like there's always something.
Features always
bugs.
There's always a bear.
There's always something.
There's always a bear chasing you. There's the bear might look a little bit different, but no matter what, there's always going to be a bear chasing you. And if you don't know what to drop so that you can be running a little bit faster, you're going to get eaten every time.
Yeah. If you can't prioritize, then it doesn't matter whether you have all the runway in the world, you're not going to succeed, because the skill to prioritize is more important than the alleged freedom that having like a runway and total focus will do. People obsess about the idea of focus as a thing that they can have versus the skill of focusing, which you can do no matter what your situation is, if you have the skill, if you develop the skill. It's kind of like doing it on the side is really a good preparation for actually running the business itself.
Right. And so if there's a consistent pattern to what you're choosing to focus on, it ends up being the things that make the most sense are the things that are going to pay off, not just now, not just going to, you know, resolve the issue that's in front of you. It's the long-term payoff, sort of this more, you know, self-investment mindset. How do I get what I really want is to take one step, little step closer to it, rather than bank up so that I can take one giant leap forward, that right. giant leap that'll never happen, by the way. Take that one giant, theoretical giant leap forward and ultimately never get there.
Right. And actually, yeah, you're right. The giant leap is like part and parcel of this particular myth that the idea that you can suddenly have what you want somehow. But really, you just have to build it up by increments. So listeners, in case you're not like fully aware of Alex's history, you might wonder, who is this Alex guy who's always doing this stuff with Amy? Does he have a software as a service I don't know about? And the answer is no, but it's also yes.
That's right.
So Freckle is going to cross $1 million in lifetime revenue this year. And so is Indy Hall, which is Alex's not software, but as a service monthly recurring billing thing. Alex runs something called Indy Hall, which is a co-working community and has more than 10,000 square feet of space, right?
Yeah. And 250 members on our current monthly roster.
Right. So Alex has this giant two-floor office. A year ago, can you believe it? A year ago, they cut through the floor of one floor and expanded into the second floor and opened sort of an art gallery space. And it's just incredible. And you have to see it to believe it. So Alex, and it runs on the subscription model as well. You pay a monthly fee for service, but also access to the community. And unlike us, Alex has a huge liability in the form of rent and insurance to cover as well. So when you opened Indy Hall, did you start with 5,000 square feet, Alex?
No, not even close. No, it was...
With any square feet?
That's actually the beautiful part. When people walk into Indy Hall today and they see, you know, literally hundreds of people occupying, you know, close to 10,000 square feet and all of the art on the walls and all of the buzz and activity, especially when they're people who are considering setting up a co-working space just like it, they imagine this, the outcome that is now 6 years later. If we could get in a time machine, if we can get into a time traveling DeLorean and go back to 2006, when there was no 1,000 square feet, where there was literally me and a handful of people in a cafe, but the core pain that we were solving was there. So, you know, our prototype, much like Freckles, was, you know, effortless time tracking, effortless time entry, and then all this other stuff that sucked. Ours was, well, at least we can get together, even if it's not the ideal way to do it. And it took a lot of time and a lot of incremental growth, much like a SaaS or any product business, in order to be able to build up to the thing. But if I had in my head, you know, 6 years ago that we were going to, you know, find a way to somehow squirrel away all of the money or raise it from an investor or borrow from friends and family and open this place. What I would have failed on is the fact that it would have taken us 6 years to ultimately fill it. And we would have died much before we ever got there.
Right. And I think that almost any product business of any kind that you look at, or any movement or anything like that you look at it from the outside and you go, oh, it must have started like this, but it never does. Almost never. Like, the chances of that happening, like, millions and millions of users on day one, like, not even Facebook or Instagram had that. It's ridiculous to think so. And of course, when you're talking about money, the multiples are a lot smaller. Like, we didn't start with 100 customers. We didn't even start with 80 customers. We didn't even start with 50 customers. And so when you start a product, you have to be willing to work on this longer time scale. You have to be willing to invest today for a much smaller immediate outcome, but for a much bigger, longer lasting outcome in the future. It's, you have to have the investment mindset, and it's really tough to have that in today's world. I hate Saul for using that phrase, but the fact of it is, if you're on this phone call, chances are you are from like a middle-class family and you went to school, and the chances are very good that you went to college, and no one ever in there taught you that you had to sit down and wait for something. You know, you weren't a farmer. You didn't grow up seeing that you plant the seeds and you wait 6 months before you even know if it's going to be, you know, a good harvest, or it may not be a good harvest, and you still have to do it again. Like, we didn't grow up with that in our worldview, and no one told us. They said, if you go to college and if you graduate, then employers will know that you have the time, you like the energy to pursue a project. But yeah, not really, because at college, everyone tells you what to do.
Right, and worse is your customers don't care. In this particular case, they don't care that you put in the time to go to college or to work your way up through the management chain at your previous job, or all of the years of time that you put into learning whatever skill it is that you're really good at. They don't care. And so you need to work on building little things that they can care about and that they will get value out of, so that they can come on board. And we've got sort of a metaphor. If you've seen, Amy's got a video called Stacking the Bricks, that we sort of use this brick stacking metaphor to explain this incremental approach to building much larger things, one tiny little thing at a time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. To stop reading the stories about instant overnight success and understand that even stuff like Twitter, like everyone's media darling, did not start as Twitter. It was a side project at Odeo. And Odeo was not what's-his-face Ev's first thing. Ev had already built and sold two different companies. It's like a 15-year overnight success story.
Right.
So there are no overnight success stories. And you have to get in the mindset of suffering now, in as much as working for an hour and not getting paid for an hour is suffering. Let's be honest, that's not really suffering, but it feels like it. Turning away clients, charging more money, and taking fewer clients, you know, like, you have to invest.
So
really, investment is the key.
So we're about halfway through the call already. I think it's time for us to get down to some tactical stuff, if people are still paying attention.
Absolutely.
So we're going to introduce this notion of brick stacking. And brick stacking in the context of making the transition from freelancing and clients to having a product-based business that replaces all of your freelancing clients, that's brick stacking in and of itself. It's all the, what are the little things that you can do? What are the little changes that you can make that sets you up, not just for the success right in front of you, but for the next success as well? So,
right.
So why don't we start by, you know, there's this entire notion of trading your time for money. And that's sort of like, that's the first thing I think people need to erase from their brains in terms of making this transition successfully, because every single time you're looking at the clock going, well, I spent that hour working on my thing instead of getting paid, it's brutal. Like you said, it's painful and horrible, but in all of those not so painful and horrible ways. But it's that the reality of that is the reason it's painful, the reason it's horrible, is because you're in the mindset that your hour is worth a certain amount of money.
Right.
And that is the very first thing that's holding you back.
We all are habituated.
Yeah, there, brutally.
It's like Yeah, we've been in a Skinner box, and we're like, all right, push button, get pigeon food. And if the button, you press the button and nothing happens, you're like, WTF, I expected pigeon food. This is bullshit. I'm gonna go watch Buffy now.
Well, if you're not trading your money for time, then how do you even change that in the first place?
So the more I've tried to teach people, the more I realize that the major barrier to everyone's success is themselves. Like you can, I worked with tons of people who claim that they want a product and they claim and appear at first to have the investment mindset, but as soon as the product is not making as much money as they want right away, and then a client comes along and offers them a check, they jump on the client. And so the first thing you need to do is just resolve, I am not going to just, react to the high of somebody offering me a check. And if you are struggling to pay your bills, this is obviously not what you should be doing. You have to secure, like have a good client base and have a good hourly rate before you can consider doing products. You're not, it's not going to help you because it's not an immediate result. There's just no instant success stories here.
And to that end, for all of the value that you can gain out of having a product-based business income, in terms of recurring income and the freedom, the true freedom that it gives you compared to this sort of work for yourself, except you're really working for your clients approach to freelancing, that comes after you're at least able to take care of yourself. If you need, what's beautiful is you can make changes to the way you pay your bills as a freelancer, or even as an employee. You can make changes that will set you up and start helping you shift that mindset. So one of the
Specific
first,
tactics.
let's talk about some of these specific tactics. So it starts with the fact that you probably currently get paid from your client, and you think that it's because you write Ruby code, or you design web pages, or you write marketing copy for them, or whatever it is that you do. You think about the thing that you do all day and say, well, that's why they pay me.
I'm a Ruby developer. I get paid to write Ruby code.
And the
It
first
seems obvious.
it does. And I can't fault people for thinking that way. Again, for all of the reasons that we said before, that's sort of
Nobody teaches you otherwise,
it's that
ever. There's no one in
Skinner
your whole
box.
life probably who ever has said, you're not actually getting paid to type code or even test code.
So the first question that you can ask yourself is, why do I get paid? Not and the answer, obviously, as we've just said, is not because I write Ruby code. So the question is the person who writes the check to you, the person who, pays that, who signs that paycheck, whether that's technically your boss or your client or whatever it may be, why you? What do you do for them that makes it worth it to them to write a check? And that
What
starts, that's
results do
that.
they get or anticipate getting from what you do?
And so the difference is instead of thinking about your time, well, because it might be easy to say, well, they're paying me for my time. If they're not paying me for my Ruby code, they must be paying me for my time. And the reality is your time as a made up construct to begin with doesn't give them value either. So it can't be your time. It must be something, some result. So if you can start answering for yourself, what result do I give the people that pay me? You can start looking at even how much they pay you and realize, wow, there's a mismatch here, isn't there?
Or you might find that you're working with clients who will never get the results that will allow you to charge more because they suck. Also possible.
Also
So if
possible.
you inter are interested specifically, the bottom line here is you want to find ways to raise your rate. And you can only raise your rate. You can't, I mean, you can just say, oh, my rate's higher. But if you want to continually raise your rate, you need to, one, ensure that you actually help your clients in a ideal situation, get a lot of value from your work, which means focusing on what they need and what their business needs and not just what you do. And two, you need to be able to communicate that effectively. Now, this is not a class on that. Actually, I would recommend Brennan's Double Your Freelancing Rate ebook for that, or Double Your Freelance Rate, which actually Brennan's a 30 by 500 student, and after has it been 2 years? I think it's 2 years since he took 3,500.
Yeah, 2 years, definitely 2 years.
His app, PlanScope, has finally just now crossed five figures of monthly recurring revenue. That's how long it takes, folks. But in the meantime, he's been working on other ways to.
And that's 2 years of Brennan, like Brennan hustling, not hustling in that like obnoxious, I'm killing myself kind of way, but like Brennan works really hard, also really smart. Like he's taken, Brennan's not just putting in the time, but he's really taken to the how do I create more value as quickly and efficiently as possible, and it's still taken him that long.
Yeah, that's just the way that it works. But once you build up recurring revenue, it doesn't just disappear overnight.
Right.
And it's easier to make it grow.
Right.
So first thing you want to do, raise your rates. And the best way to do that is to understand your position in the business of the people who are paying you. And I, again, recommend Double Your Freelance Rate by Brennan. It's really good. The second thing you want to do is when you charge more, work less. I was a very bad freelancer for a very long time. I'll just preface that. I was sucked. I would take pretty much any work that showed up. I gave people huge discounts for no reason, and I was just grateful that they would give me the work. And I was constantly living month to month, and it sucked. When I went back to freelancing after having a couple of jobs and having established what that is I do and understanding business better, I learned to be selective. I went from charging like $50 an hour, 3 years later charging like $250 plus. And it's really not that I personally changed, it's my understanding of business and what I was doing for my clients changed. And then it's still tempting though to have the habit to take all the work that comes by that'll pay your rate. You're like, all right, do you seem like not an asshole? Do I seem like I could do good work for you? Will you pay my rate? Great, I'll take you if I have time. But you don't want to fill up your time, because if you fill up your time, you won't have any time to work on your products. You need to guard your time jealously, be more discriminating, charge more, and work less. And it really is that easy.
We have a great story from a recent 30 by 500 alumni who is freelancing it. In his career for a while, and had a couple of clients that he thought were good clients, and sort of had an epiphany that he needed to start making this transition. He recently wrote our alumni list to sort of tell a little bit of a story of it took him a really long time to even be willing to accept this new perspective of presenting value instead of an ability, so to speak. And he was able to consolidate all of his client work down into two large monthly retainer client deals, which is a lot different from X number of dollars an hour, and I'm going to get an average of 30 hours a month. But sometimes it'll be a little bit higher because they need more, or because I really kind of need to make some extra cash to pay off this other bill. And so he removed that ability entirely from his scope and said, I'm going to take on two clients. I'm going to charge them this way. And not only is that going to make me more money, but it's going to leave me with close to 50% of my time, equivalent to what I was spending before, to work on the other bricks that I want to stack so that I can get away from consulting entirely.
Right. And he used the 30 by 500 way of discovering the customer's pain and then pitching them to secure those contracts. And he said, you know, I really wanted to be doing products by now, but I just didn't get off my ass and do it. But I used the same process to secure these clients on retainer, and like it really does work for anything. It's really, whether you're selling a product or consulting, you need to understand the customer or client's pain and also their outcomes.
Yeah. And I think he even admitted that, like, not perfectly executed. He's like, I don't think I nailed this, but it worked. And so that's another beautiful thing. Like, you don't have to be, this goes back to that, like, that giant leap thing. Like, you don't have to study this to be an expert in order for it to work. You can learn it enough to do 10% of it and still have better results than simply doing what you've been doing, which ultimately isn't working.
Right. Yeah. You definitely don't want to wait till things are perfect or you have perfect knowledge, because there's no such thing.
Right.
I make mistakes all the time. I just realized, in fact, that we had contacted GoToWebinar to upgrade the number of people here. But we're getting all these error messages, people trying to join the can't because GoToWebinar said that they had upgraded us and they didn't.
Or
so
they did, but something didn't take. But
gonna email us and they're gonna be like, I thought you said I could get in, and we're gonna have to say, oh, I'm so sorry, it didn't work out. But are they gonna hate us forever? No. It's like mistakes happen all the time. Like I wrote in my recent email, mistakes are not barriers to success. They are toll booths. Mistakes are the cost of moving forward, not something that should stop you from moving forward. You're going to make the mistakes no matter what, so you might as well move forward anyway. So we looked at charging more money, and part of that is understanding your clients better. Then using that then as a reason to work less and to not just say yes to any pretty check that walks up to you. It is really hard, even when you have enough money and you know that you have enough work and you know that you have something else to do with that time, it is so hard to walk away from a juicy project. You think, oh, wow, I would get recognition, or, oh, wow, that would be a lot of money. Think how much nicer it would be to have an extra $10,000, $20,000 in my bank account. But
that's not the investment mindset.
The mindset of an addict.
Right. Exactly.
And I say this with complete empathy because I was totally like that.
Yeah.
Even in the middle of, after I had quit consulting, I had a couple offers. One of them was from Bank Simple, back when they were like the hottest thing ever. And then they kind of fizzled out and no one talked about them anymore. But at the time, they were super hot and they're like, we want you to tell us, you know, what would you do with our interface? I was like, oh my God, this would be so cool. But I said no. I said no to the job. I said, I would maybe do a small consulting project for you. My price is really high. Here it is. And they walked away. And really, looking back, I wouldn't have even offered to do consulting. I kind of priced it so high that it was like a no shit. Like, if they pay me this much money, it's worth it. But looking back, it wasn't even worth it. I would have said no. But I was still kind of in the addict mindset, so I kind of set it up so it would be hard for me to take the next hit, but not impossible.
Yeah.
And looking back, I would make it impossible. If someone wants me to consult, I just say no. Now. It doesn't matter how much money it is or who it is for.
It's like being able to shake a money tree is an addiction, and it's a bad way to run a business. It's a really bad way to run a business.
Unless that money tree is you providing like an ebook or workshop or something to customers who then, you know, pay you and then go away. selling a product or doing a workshop over and over is much different than doing consulting for a client.
But even then, the big difference is that it's not that they go away. In fact, it's that they stick around, but they continue bringing you a growth of value. It's not that they just come back
That's true.
Same hit every time. It's that they're laying another foundation, another row of bricks for you to move towards your goal. If it's keeping you from advancing, it's not brick stacking, it's boat anchoring. And you taking that gig with Simple would have ultimately been a boat anchor on you moving towards the goal that you really wanted. And so being able to identify the difference between something that short term seems like it advances you, but if you can't see how it advances you towards the big goal, then it's actually not advancing you at all. It's slowing you down.
Very true. Very true. So, yeah, when I said, and then they go away, I was thinking about how annoying clients are. Like, they just keep, like, client projects either end and then it's totally out of control, or they kind of never end, in my experience. Granted, I'm not the world's best consultant.
Right.
So, could be I was doing something wrong. But when you sell somebody an ebook, for example, and then they buy into your ebook premise and they like start taking your advice, then they may in the future want something next step. Like, here you are in this webinar. If you want to take the next step and learn how to figure out what products do people really want to buy so you can make the most of your time that you've kind of segmented off from your consulting, chances are good that you'll consider our class. Right? And I'm not like, you must take 30 by 500. And when you walk out the door, so to speak, I'm not going to be like, you should take 30 by 500 for 50% off. There's no hard sell here and there's no big discount. But if you like this information, you like what we're thinking, chances are good you'll consider us next time. Right? And that is how you stack bricks.
Right. So I think we've got one more tip sort of on our list before maybe we want to tackle a couple of questions that people wrote in with. And this one's sort of the goodie for the people who this can be used if you're freelancing, but this is super useful if you find yourself in that job situation and you're trying to figure out, all right, this is all nice if I'm, you know, if I get to say no to the next client. But what about when, you know, I'm not the one choosing who the clients are, and this is more like I am at a job, so I am like kind of committed to a certain number of hours. And so all I have is nights and weekends. And to be fair, you can do a lot of damage nights and weekends, is, you know, you, Amy built Freckle effectively. You could spread out nights and weekends over a period of time and build that. And Indie Hall was built originally in my nights and weekends as well. So you can do a lot in nights and weekends, but if you're looking to accelerate things, we've got this pretty sweet little tip for people who are in the job situation and are looking to to take the next step. So
let me set the scene for this, because when I did this, I was not the Amy Hoy that everyone knows and loves. That was sarcasm, by the way. I was kind of a nobody. I was doing PHP development and interaction design inside a company that you've never heard of. Nobody read my blog. I had no fame whatsoever. No, like, social capital, really, other than what got me the job and then the jobs after that, by basically asking people on IRC that I knew they wanted to hire me. So I was not any kind of powerful, well-connected, well-respected, well-known anything at this time. I wanted to work on my book for O'Reilly, and that never worked out, and that's a long, boring story that also led me to self-publish. But I didn't want to work 5 hours a week, 5 days a week anymore, 9 to 5. And instead, I thought about jumping jobs. I thought about working for ThoughtWorks. ThoughtWorks was a big deal Ruby consulting company. I don't know if you guys know about them, but back in the day, they were major, like the Ruby consulting company. The perks and stuff were pretty sweet. They gave me a job offer for more than 50% more than my current salary was at this job. Maybe it was more like 40%. 40% more than my current salary. But I didn't want to fly around the country consulting on bullshit corporate projects. So I went to my current bosses and I said, look, here's my offer letter for $80,000 plus more vacation. And that to me at the time was a huge amount of money. Again, I was not like famous or Amy Hoy or anything back then. I said, I don't want to actually take this job, but I will, because, you know, logic dictates. I would rather work here, but what I would rather prefer is to work 4 days a week and have my salary stay exactly the same. And that worked. I was basically shaking. I'm pretty sure that they could tell from my voice that I was fucking freaked out. And again, I did not have a whole lot of bargaining power at this time except that job offer. And this was a very sort of staid kind of company. And they said yes. And I've given this advice to a lot of people over time, and several people have taken it and worked and gotten to a four-day work week. And I don't mean like a four-day work week where you work 12 hours a day. No, I mean 9 to 5 or 9 to 6, but only 4 days a week. 4 or 5 people have taken my advice and had it work for them.
And just to qualify, had it work, that means that they walked in and said, you know, instead of this promotion, I would like to carve out some more time for myself.
Or instead of quitting,
I would like to stay here, but I need more time for myself. Instead of that, can we do this? And all of the people that have done it have been not laughed out of the room, which I think is our number one fear. When you ask for something like that, that's such an atypical request of an employer or even a long-term client or anything like that. Our assumption is they're just going to like, bah, you know, you're crazy. Get back to work. Deal's off. I'm not even going to give you the raise. They were said, you know, people took it and they said, that's a really interesting offer. We should probably talk about it. And said, yes. And yes. I think that's the important
part. And reported back, Amy, you wrecked my life. They fired me. No one. Or even they said no.
And I think
that if someone took my advice and got fucked over, they would tell me.
But I think the important part about this is it's also, I think it reflects back to what we were talking about earlier, is that this is you taking a very, very intentional step towards taking control of your time instead of assuming that if I want to get paid, I must give up my time.
Right.
And that's what I think that is the core lesson of this entire conversation today.
Really, is it's not to take what other people offer you.
Exactly. Is the reason that people unsuccessfully do not complete the transition from freelancing or a job into a product-based business is because the product business, the business that you want to start, is never going to advocate for itself the way that advocate for your time, more importantly, in the way that a client or a boss will. And that means that you need to take control of it because the business itself, the product business, can't do it. And that's
right.
It will
never be able to scream the loudest.
That is the shift.
Yeah.
So with that, I see a couple of really good questions, and I've got one that I want to jump on.
Awesome. Go for it.
And that is, true or false, client work is a rite of passage or necessary evil to gain the knowledge, experience, and authority needed to launch a product. I don't think so either, but I think, first of all, definitely not a requirement. However, there is an advantage to it. I was just talking about this with Jeff, my business partner at Indie Hall last night, because he was asking about who takes 3,500. You know, it seems like it's mostly designers, developers, freelancers, da da da. And I said, he said, do you require that they're freelancers? And I said, we don't require it, but the people who have freelance tend to have an advantage because they understand business a little bit better. And even if you're a really shitty freelancer, you at least figured out enough how to, like, some of the basic tactical stuff of being in business for yourself. If you've only ever had a job and you've never even done side work, it's not that this won't work for you. It's just that you're at a bit of a disadvantage. And so doing a little bit of consulting on the side, so long as it's not enough for you to get totally hooked and, you know, start tapping that vein.
Take a couple hits.
It's just a little bit is valuable, not for the experience of doing that work in a freelancing environment, but the freelancing starts to give you a taste of not the challenges of who's going to advocate for your work, because freelancing really just changes who your boss is, right? It's less likely to be you. It changes your boss from being a person who said, yes, you can work here, to someone who said, yes, I'd like to hire you. That's not really any different. But what it does teach you is some basic business skills, and I think that that can be valuable. I think it's way, 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 way less important in terms of gaining knowledge, experience, and authority in whatever the pain you're going to solve. Because the truth is, the pain that you're solving doesn't care if you're a freelancer or an employee or what you gain that knowledge. It's more the business experience that you get, the basic business experience that you get from freelancing that can be valuable.
Absolutely, because you have to go through a process of, you know, interviewing clients and like proposals usually and contracts, and they'll have questions and they'll be like, why should I hire you? And all this stuff helps.
Yeah, and I think it teaches some things about it, about not just the work, but also about yourself, and says, you know, if I can hack this, I can definitely hack product.
Yeah, if you can survive as a consultant and make a good living, then you can absolutely create a product business. Will you? Well, that's another story. But if you have the skills in the background to get people to pay you to build things for them or to design things for them or to write things for them, you can absolutely turn that around and make products.
Yeah.
And so we really prefer that people who take 3,500 have some kind of business background, if not freelancing or consulting, and actually running their own business.
Or even if you're in a company, you've spent enough time, maybe you've worked with the owner or the CEO, like you have an understanding of how business actually works, which is going to make it easier for you to understand value. There's another question that I think I know what the answer is, but I think, Amy, I'd like to hear you answer it. Only because we've touched on it a little bit, but I think it's good to answer concretely. The question is, everyone, you know, us and Brennan and Patrick and Nathan seem to love selling products, and I'm convinced it's great, but what sucks about it? Is there anything that's not so great about selling products versus consulting?
Oh, yeah. The thing I hate most about selling products probably applies to consulting too, if you're like being a professional person.
Which is paperwork? Yeah.
Administration.
That stuff never really goes away until you get to a point where you can afford to outsource it. But I think there's a better answer, to be honest with you.
Okay. So I personally love the existential freedom of selling products. I know a lot of people don't. I love it. But, I don't actually know which problem you're going for, but I've got one.
What's yours?
Rarely will you have a client who will cancel a check and write you nasty emails. That happens from time to time when you sell products.
Well, it's true. That's true.
If you're thin-skinned, that can really hurt. At first, it's really upsetting.
The thing that I think is the fact that it's slow. Is that it takes time.
Fair. It doesn't really bother me.
It doesn't bother you, but however you can say that now because you've taken the time. That's exactly it. Yeah. I think it's not even a matter of patience and perseverance. It's the willingness to play the long game. That does require some, as we said earlier, some sacrifices in a completely reasonable scale of making sacrifices. But the truth is you can't start a business like this today and having quit your job yesterday and be okay. It takes time. And effort.
I know people are like, I have 3 or 4 months of runway. I quit my job. I'm like, not that.
You can launch a consulting business and go score clients the same day and have your rent paid and your bills paid that month and potentially for months to come. But you're going to have to keep doing that. You're not building and growing. You're creating something that it's got sort of a finite.
P.S. Passive income is a lie.
It is work. Just because you get paid in your sleep doesn't mean you're not working in other ways all the time.
You get to reap, once you've invested your time and your effort for years, you get to reap that for many years to come. It's not like 1 hour you get $20 back.
Sure.
That out 1 hour you spent, 1 year it'll be worth 20, the next year it'll be worth 40 and 60 and 80. But that's the same hour, not you work another hour the next year and it gets worth more.
Sure.
But it will accrue, which is not true of consulting. But it's still, you have still have to spend that time and invest that time and energy. It's never, there's no such thing truly as passive income.
Yeah.
But
So I one more question I think we have time for, maybe two. The next one is sort of this balance. Now, we talked about the notion of carving out time, whether that be one day a week or, a certain number of hours a day to be working on brick stacking effectively. But there's an element of task switching. I think the question is asking, what is the best way to balance when you're transitioning from client work to working on a product? What is the good way to keep the frequency? Sorry, motorcycles. What is a good way to keep frequency when building an audience and building on the product? Basically, how often do I need to be working on my product business? Is that something that I should be doing a little bit a day, a little bit a week, once a month? How far apart do the intervals get that it's no longer really valuable?
I think you absolutely have to work on it every single week. However, if you fall down 1 week or another week, or even like we did for a couple months at a time, get back on the horse. I have seen people who did exactly what I did with Freckle, which was they totally ignored their business for 3 months, and then the email piled up, and they felt so horribly guilty that they never went back to it, which is stupid. It's like if you miss somebody's birthday, you don't then not talk to them ever again. I mean, there were times in my life where I was so socially awkward that if I screwed up something socially, I would never talk to that person again. And then I realized that's idiotic. The same thing with the business.
So this relates to
regularly, but if you mess up, get back on the horse.
This relates to another question, which is how do you handle the sadness that results from working on a product that's making no money when you could have been consulting for many dollars per hour? I'm going to sort of abstract that question away into how do I get over myself when I feel like maybe I made the wrong choice?
Okay.
And I think the answer here is if all you want to do is beat yourself up, then you're here to beat yourself up. And instead, as Amy just said, when you screw up, whether it's because you chose a wrong audience or you built something that nobody wants or whatever it may be, you can wallow in it. And that's about as bad as taken another hit of the client dollars. It's, you know, you're not moving forward. Or you can say, well, this isn't working and I made a mistake, but I can stay an idiot. I can stay a person who made a mistake, or I can do something different and figure out how that different thing can actually get me closer to my goal. So the point is the way you handle sadness is to say, you know what? I screwed up. It's okay. I'm just going to not do that again.
Yes. I would like to elaborate on that.
Yeah.
So the more that I teach people and the more that I study philosophy and psychology, the more I think that bad feelings are often a kind of reward.
What do you mean by that?
I'm gathering my thoughts how to explain. I wrote a post recently called The Harsh Truth About Fear, where I basically said that people say, I would do X, but I'm afraid, and yet they do all other kinds of things that would cause fear, like take their driver's tests or ask somebody to marry them, things like that, that are even more scary than, say, launching a product. Like, if no one buys your ebook, what's going to happen? Meanwhile, if you get in a car and you drive someplace and you have a car accident, you could die. Or if you ask the love of your life to marry you and she turns you down or he turns you down, like, that is a much bigger consequence. Yet people get married all the time, and people who get married will still say, I'm too scared to launch a product. It doesn't make sense. Fear, I think, is used more as an excuse to do nothing, and because there's some sort of weird pleasure in maintaining the status quo and saying, oh, in my fantasies, I would do all this, but fear is stopping me. And I don't mean to sound at all condescending, because I definitely, earlier in my life, was with, say, a boyfriend or two who I think I picked because they would never really love me, if that makes sense. Kind of like it confirmed my self-image. If that makes sense, I think that's pretty common, actually. I think a lot of people make that kind of mistake. But you can make it with business, too. You can be like, oh, well, I feel bad because I didn't make any money, and it's not going to make any money, and I can wallow a little bit, and then I can go on with my life and not actually face the challenge of sitting down to fix it and persist. It can be kind of its own reward, because it lets you maintain the status quo. And if there's anything that our egos like, it's the status quo. If we can't have amazing success, we want the status quo.
There's Amy, I'm going to have to, because we're out of time today, but also because it's, I have to extract from my notes, that Simon Sinek talk that I went to yesterday was one of the things that he was talking about that's coming out in his new book. He sort of, he did an analysis of the chemicals that sort of control our happiness. And I don't have the notes in front of me, so I can't remember exactly which one it is, but I will write this post that I believe supports that theory, in the fact that there's a chemical that we've evolved to have that essentially we release it to dull pain. There are certain interactions that we have, and this releases in the body, and it is like any chemical, you can get addicted to it. And so, so that sort of self-excusing wallowing we do in a way to get our body to release that chemical because it feels good. The problem
is also less work to wallow than to change.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
So in a way, not having to work is a reward as well. And that's interesting. I want to hear about that.
Yeah. It was really cool.
You can totally break out of this mindset and this habit. The thing is that we teach people in our class, and that I'm going to teach you right now, is when you say, okay, I have a product that's not selling, the temptation is to say, oh, I failed, it's wrong, no one will buy it, that was a waste of time, blah, 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 blah. And you just overcome with uncertainty and self-pity and regret, because you're looking at the way that you feel and what happened versus evidence of what's possible. So the number one lesson of 30 by 500, and I've blogged about this and posted videos, is you look for evidence. You don't say, I'm going to create X because it'll be fun to create, and oh yeah, the world will love it. You go and you find out, what do people suffer with now that I can help with? And then if you're wallowing, if you find yourself wallowing, you're like, no one's buying my ebook on how to raise your rates. You can go, well, was my research bad? Can I go out and find that these people are still talking about their problems caused by low rates? Then I know that I do kill a pain or help kill a pain. I do fill a need. I must be doing something else wrong, but that, like, the fundamental conception of the product is right.
And that recent post, that recent post from Yana really sort of illustrates this in its
Absolutely.
greatest form. So if you haven't read that post, go back and do it, because it's exactly what Amy's describing right now. It was, I
She
made a
wrote
mistake.
happybootstrapper.com is her blog.
Right. And so because Yana had done the research and she knew that she was solving a real pain, she was able to say, well, what else went wrong? And she came back to the 30 by 500 list and said, what did I do wrong? And she'd skipped other steps, but it wasn't, she made a mistake that was not an unfixable mistake, is the really important part. The type of mistake that she made was completely fixable and without rebooting all the way back to square one. She didn't have to say, well, I built the wrong product and nobody's ever going to buy this.
But her first reaction when her launch, quote unquote, failed was to wallow.
Yeah, it
Then she picked
was.
herself up, which is great.
It's true.
So that's the thing, is don't wallow. Don't give yourself all this negative self-talk. God, we sound like a therapy session right now.
Well, and
Or have it in.
maybe that's a good point. And part of this is also like to, in order to not wallow, outside perspective, I think, is really what helped Yana pick herself up. Whether that was on the 30 by 500 list or wherever she gets that, you know, we have our everyone should have their own little community. Even if it's just a couple of people, doing this by yourself is a whole lot harder than doing it with even a few people that are going through the same mess that you are and are making the same mistakes you are. If they're making the same mistakes you are and not learning from it, that's bad. That's poison. But if they can help you recognize your own mistakes easier than you can recognize your own mistakes, having the support of a couple other people around you to say, get up off the ground. You know you did the research. You know that people are going to buy this. You screwed something else up. Let's take a look at what it might be. Can is a big, big, big help to be able to make to pick yourself up and make that step forward.
Absolutely. So I think we're a little over time, but there's one more question that showed up in the webinar control panel that I would like to address.
Sure, let's do it.
Robert Evans asked, "You built Freckle when there were many time tracking software. How do you, I have two questions. How did you make Freckle stand out, and did you validate Freckle before building it? If so, how?" So both of these questions are wrong questions. No offense, Robert. It's not that they're bad questions. In fact, they're the questions that everyone says are what you should ask. So no shame in asking them, but they're not the right questions because of the following facts. Crowded markets actually create customers because the more people who use a tool, the higher chance that there's a large percentage of people who use it who are unhappy. If there is only one textbook for a class in college all across the United States, you know that there must be at least 10 or 15% of students at minimum who fucking hate it. You know, we're all different. We have different needs and different abilities and different things that we're willing to tolerate. Now, I didn't say I'm going to build a time tracking software. How do I make it different? Instead, I looked at all the issues that people who were already using time tracking software or who refused to use time tracking software were suffering from. And the number one pain is it's so annoying to track my time, I don't do it. That is the pain that we attacked. And that is why we shipped basically with just time entry and the most basic reporting and nothing else. We made time tracking, entering the time itself, really, really fast. You didn't have to click around the interface. You didn't have to set stuff up. You basically just started typing and it was smart and it was done. Really easy. And so I didn't need to differentiate it because I actually solved a pain that people who already had different software were still having. And I didn't have to validate it because I didn't come up with something and then seek evidence. I looked at the problems people were already having. And if they were already having this problem with software, they were already paying for that software. For example, Harvest, thousands of users.
Thousands of users, many of whom were unhappy.
Right. So I'm like, okay, well, this software almost creates this problem for people. People are still paying for it. That means they have a problem, they have a pain. I see what that pain is from research and from experience and from looking at my friends and also looking online. People complain about the hassle of tracking time. They dismiss it offhand. They're like, I just estimate or I do project quotes because it's just not worth it to track my time. I know that they're losing money because they're doing this. and I see that people are paying for the software that's bad. This causes this very particular pain. We're going to kill that particular pain, and people who pay for the other software probably can lure some over to pay for ours. Just simple jump from one to the other. If that makes sense. That is what we teach in 30 by 500, by the way.
Yep.
But you don't have to take a class to start doing this research yourself. If you want to learn how to do it, how to do the research with great confidence and speed, then take our class. If you want to go and figure it out on your own, that's what I did. It's possible. It just takes longer.
Right.
And it's more alone, you know. I'm a research nerd, so
yeah, I don't know anyone who enjoys the research like you do.
It's true.
Everyone's got a weird guilty pleasure. Yours is research.
Really, it is. I mean, I have other guilty pleasures too, like Doritos, but that's normal.
Yes.
So let's wrap it up, everybody. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you for sticking with us. We only lost like 10 people this entire time. So seriously, thank you. Thank you for staying. I hope this wasn't too rambly. I hope that you got value out of it. Just to recap, start freeing yourself now. Figure out how to raise your rates, work fewer hours. Whether or not you're employed or not, this is good advice. Create time where you regularly sit down to work on your product once a week, at least. Try to disabuse yourself of the kind of entrained habit of responding, you know, stimulus response. Don't be the pigeon in the Skinner box where the button lights up and you peck it and you get food. Look at what you do automatically. Like, don't just jump on any offer that you get. Don't just always focus on the thing that screams the loudest. Learn to focus on things that you want, that you can invest in exchange for a long-term return. It's hard. Personally, like, your own habits, the biggest barrier. But it's totally doable because it's inside you. You are in the best position to make that change. That's all I got.
Yeah, I have no other closing thoughts. That was a nice wrap-up. So thank you absolutely to everyone who stuck around for the hour. If you have questions about, you know, making sure that 30 by 500 is right for you, if you're interested, shoot us an email.
Let us know.
We've got about 2/3 of the seats are for next weekend's bootcamp are left.
Yep, that's right.
So if you have any questions, is this right for you? Is this going to be the right fit? Are you ready for it now? Should I maybe take it later? Shoot us an email. Happy to make sure that this is the right time for you. And we'll see you back on the interwebs.
Yeah, and also, if you enjoy this, we would love a tweet. We're going to also do our best to get you the recording. Hopefully it worked.
Fingers crossed.
And let us know what you liked and what you would like us to do differently next time. We'd really appreciate that feedback.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That'd be great. Because I think we want to do stuff like this again.
Yeah, definitely.
And I think maybe this new format threw us a little bit. So we're really wide open to constructive criticism and things like that. This is something that we know we can make better. What we focus our energy on making better is really going to be dependent on what we hear from you guys.
Absolutely. So please let us know, both positive and negative. You know, we're really excited to hear it. Yep. Thank you so much. We are signing off. We will email you the recording, assuming we can get it. And just, you know, hit reply and let us know what you thought.
Cool. All right.
Thank you.
Bye, Amy. Bye, everybody.
Bye.